Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. This is Jamie Floyd sitting in for Brian Lehrer. Lost in the discussion of the current economic crisis and recovery has been a public dialogue of the reasons for the collapse. We've all heard the financial product jargon like credit default swaps and subprime mortgage lending. But the jump from what those things actually are to how their creation led to one of the worst global financial crises in history is pretty obscure. So in his new book, I Owe You, Why Everyone Owes Everyone and No One Can Pay, John Lanchester tells the story in plain English of how the decisions of a small group of people created the recent financial implosion. And he's joining us now to help us come to terms with the decisions that led to the crisis. John, welcome.
Good morning, Jamie.
Well, let's start with the basics. What changed with the bank's invention of the ATM machine?
Well, I think I saw ATMs very early because I was brought up in Asia. And so the first ATM I came across would be in about 1970. And I remember thinking there was something, I was 8 years old, and I remember being completely freaked out by it. There was something about the ease with which a stick just sort of spat money out. And it just seemed too kind of frictionless and unnatural. That money would just come, you know, vomiting out of this thing into the world with no check and no restraint. And then, of course, I gradually got used to ATM machines. And now I start to wonder if, you know, maybe I was right. There was something unnatural about this kind of completely frictionless movement of money around the world.
Well, maybe we all got a little too used to the ease with which the money comes out.
Yes, and the thing, an early point in the book, I mentioned the thing that happened to an Icelandic woman I met. When she went to her ATM machine, she was studying for a graduate degree in England, and you know the card wouldn't give her any cash, and she thought, you know, the line is on the fritz, or you know I'm slightly out of funds, say, or whatever, and thought no more of it, and didn't realise, in fact, that what had happened was. It was a nightmare scenario. It wasn't just that she didn't have money. It was that the bank didn't have money. And more than that, it was, in fact, that Iceland had run out of money. The whole country was completely bankrupt. And, you know, the credit crunch really did take an awful lot of people all around the world, not just to the edge of the abyss, but actually, you know, right over it.
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. This is 93.9 FM and 820 AM WNYC and WNYC.org, and my guest is John Lanchester, a fiction writer who now turns to nonfiction to explain to us why everyone owes everyone and no one can pay. His new book is I Owe You. John, let's talk about the word risk, R-I-S-K.
Yeah.
There used to be an old children's game called Risk, I vaguely recall. It's an interesting word, and in your book you suggest that it means something very different for bankers than it does for the rest of us. What's the difference?
They use risk to mean mathematically accessible probabilities. They use risk to use it in the way that you'd use it if you were talking about a game of dice, you know, and the chance of coming up six sixes. It's not the conventional sense of risk, which includes, you know, uncertainties and that thing, you know, that everyone laughed at Donald Rumsfeld for saying, but I, in fact, think very helpful, that thing about known unknowns and unknown unknowns. Those aren't really modeled in the maths of risk that bankers use. They're just talking about things you can put very precise numbers on. And, of course, as every single adult in the whole world knows, a lot of the most surprising things that happen are very precisely things that you can't kind of put probabilities on in that way.
Hmm. John, a lot of your book is spent marveling at how each individual financial decision may make sense, but the sum of the decisions can be completely incomprehensible. When you were researching the book, do you think you got into the heads of the financial leaders enough to explain how they were able to believe so completely in what they were doing?
I think it comes down to this thing of completely putting all their faith, I mean, faith is the word, in these mathematically based models. So you had a thing like the CFO of Goldman Sachs talking about it being a 25 sigma event, the credit crunch. That's like saying, that's I mean, it's almost impossible to say how big a number that is. A 20 sigma event is 10 times all the elementary particles in the known universe. A 25 sigma event is that same number, but with a decimal point moved 52 places to the right. Okay. So that's like saying the credit crunch was the single most unlikely thing ever to have happened in the history of the universe if it were repeated, the whole history of the universe, billions of times over. And what he's talking about is poor people with bad credit having problems repaying their mortgages when house prices went down. You know, they got so far inside their own bubble and their own map of reality that they just forgot contact with just things that any one of us would have known, just by simple operation of common sense, which is that, you know, house prices had got too high and there was too much lending to people who were going to have problems sending it back.
Let's talk a little bit about the financial products that led to this financial crisis, but let's take a little step back from any individual product.
Yeah.
Things like credit default swaps.
Yeah.
and I'm laughing because, you know, the average layperson may not even know what that is, right?
Yeah.
I mean, how is a thing like a credit default swap created, for example? And I want people to know your book is so incredibly accessible. I mean, this is a fantastic... I got the book the middle of last week, and I read it in a couple of days, which I say to you as a compliment, because I'm not a numbers person, I'm not a math person, I'm not a money person, and I loved it. It's the kind of book we all should read, given the current state of affairs.
Thank you very much.
So give people a taste of how you're able to break this down. How is a credit default swap created?
Well, in its simplest thing, it's just a kind of insurance, really. It's if you lend money to someone, to your buddy Joe down the road, and he's supposed to pay you back, say, $1,000 a month for a year, and you suddenly think, well, why don't I, you know, what if he can't pay? What if, he stops being able to pay me the $1,000 a month? And someone else comes along and says, I tell you what, I'll insure that risk for you. So if Joe has trouble and defaults, the third party will take on the burden of paying you the $1,000 a month. So in other words, he takes on the risk of the loan. It's like a kind of insurance. And what happened with lots of these things is that they're supposed to be used to reduce risk and kind of control and manage risk. And the human nature being what it is, and I think particularly the culture of investment banking being what it is, what they ended up doing with these things that are supposed to kind of bring the levels of risk down is that they use them to crank the level of risk up. Because what lots of companies did, they said, hang on a minute, we've just insured away our risk. That means our money's safe. That means we can gamble with it again. And did another loan and got credit default insurance against that, and then it did it again, and then did it again. So what ended up happening was that because they thought they had this kind of genius new way of reducing risk, they took bigger and bigger risks on. It's like, as I say in the book, it's like so they've invented seatbelts. So they suddenly say, great, you know, this is a perfect opportunity to take up drunk driving.
But is there anything to keep them from starting to say, like, if they dream something up, if you dream up the seatbelt, do they have to have a reason to start selling something? I mean, is there anything to keep them from selling something they dream up right away?
No, absolutely not. And the really cool thing about new products, once you kind of cross over to these guys' worldview, the really cool thing about new products is they're less likely to be regulated. The longer stuff has been around, the more likely it is that there are rules to control it. Mm. But they're a fantastically effective lobby. I mean, when this new stuff came along, these credit default swaps, the bank, I mean, you know, you cannot exaggerate their power as a lobby. They got Congress to pass a law. They didn't just pass a law not regulating these things, CDSs as they're called. So they didn't just not regulate them. They got Congress to pass a law banning regulation
right.
of them.
Right.
You know, I mean, it really is the case that when these guys go to the legislature and say, jump, the legislature says, how high?
I have to ask you about what I found to be a central nugget of the book, which you may or may not, as the author of your own book, IOU, agree. And this has to do with the notion of the old Cold War and your idea that capitalism sort of needed the foil of the Soviets to be all that it can be, if you will. Can you sort of explain that quickly to listeners?
Well, it's hard, you know, you can't prove it. It's just a theory. But when you start asking, you know, why do the bankers suddenly get out of control, sort of starting in the 80s and carrying on? And you can prove the ways in which they did, you know, like their pay rockets, their share of gross national product rockets. They're taking a bigger piece of the pie for themselves. And bankers will always be central to the operation of how capitalism works because credit is central. And these guys are... you know, right at the heart of it. And basically, they just start giving themselves more and more and more of the rewards. And when I started wondering about why, I do think that it's partly to do with the end of the Cold War, and that before that, there was a kind of what I call an ideological beauty contest to show whose life was better for its ordinary citizens, whether the Western Bloc or the communist states offered the ordinary Joe a better way of life. And there was lots of political capital in the idea of equality and fairness and, you know, we're all in it together. And gradually, at the end of the Cold War, that idea just fades. You never hear anything about fairness from politicians anymore. And I think that that's linked to the end of the Cold War. And this, I think it's absolutely amazing, amazing fact that I really can't get over, that the median income, that's the family in the middle, it's different from the average, because if one guy gets a $1 billion pay rise, the average pay for everyone goes up, even though everyone's being paid the same. But the median is the guy in the middle. Now, the median income in the U.S. hasn't gone up since the 1970s, mm-hmm. since 1975, the median household. That's absolutely amazing thing in the richest and most powerful country the world has ever seen, that the ordinary people aren't getting any better off. And I think the end of the Cold War is one of the reasons for that.
It's fascinating. I'm so tight on time, but I have to ask this question because I'm just incredibly curious. And I know that you can give me a quick answer. How on earth did you get to the point that you wanted to write this book? You're not a financial writer, are you? You wrote fiction. What brought you to this subject?
Well, I got fascinated by it. My father worked for a bank in the days when, you know, banking was more like It's a Wonderful Life. And so it doesn't feel like they're kind of exotic aliens. And I just got really interested. So I finished a draft of a novel and thought, you know, what the hey, I'll write this book that I think should be written, sort of explaining this stuff to myself and then also to the kind of interested general reader.
It's a Wonderful Life, you know, was fiction.
True that.
I just wanted to make sure you knew that. All right, John Lanchester, such a pleasure to have you here. His new book is I Owe You, Why Everyone Owes Everyone and No One Can Pay. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Jamie.
This is Jamie Floyd sitting in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Remember, it's not just Friday. It's Follow-Up Friday. Coming up in a minute, we're going to take your calls on your most regrettable tattoo decisions.